There you go.
What's
I'm not sure. Okay, so the class tonight is called Belief in God. And what we're going to do is we're going to touch upon, we're not going to learn everything, right? But we're going to touch upon what it means practically, what it means categorically, and what it means theoretically, right? Of what it means of the beliefs to God. For someone to believe in God. Now, let's start theoretically. What does it mean to believe in God? Okay, we throw this question out. What does it mean to believe in God?
Hope.
It's a very nice answer. I'm not sure what that means. Right? It means it provides me with hope. Yeah. But what does it mean to believe in God? I'm sorry, you got an answer? Tell me your name.
Susan.
Susan.
To believe in something bigger than myself.
Right? It's a very good answer. I believe in something bigger than myself. I am 5'8" and white, right? And therefore, I know there are many, many things that are bigger than myself. Okay? So, Ertov. So, I think that's too broad. Correct? Okay, so what else? What else? What does it mean to believe in God?
To mean that there's
to believe in a higher power. Believe in a higher power. We're getting a little more specific here, right? We're talking about a higher power. Anybody else?
A supreme being.
Anybody else?
That gives us a purpose.
It gives us a purpose. So this is where you mentioned this before, is that all of a sudden that becomes practical, mm-hmm. right? So first we're talking about theoretical, right? Or categorically, and now we're talking practical. Let's go back to theoretical. What does it mean to believe in God?
You believe in a power that you can't see or feel. You just have to assume it's there.
Uh-huh. So you're touching upon something that's very interesting. We're talking about can't control. Well, talk to my kids, right? So, right? You're talking about something about, because before we were talking about something that God is, and now you mention something that God, that a negative thing aspect of God. In other words, is that often when we describe God, right? Really, by definition, we need to describe him in the negative as opposed to the positive. What do I mean by that? Right? If I say that there is a fine line between belief of God and idolatry, right, which we'll talk about soon. And when I talk about what I believe in, right, so I have to say, well, what is God? God has no physical being, right? If you believe in God, God has no physical attributes. God doesn't have any emotional attributes. God is not. When we even say God is one, what we're really saying is God is not many, right? Because we can't really say God is one because God is beyond one. All these terms that we use, the vernacular that we're accustomed to, all these terms are describing. It's really insufficient to describe God. The only way to describe God is what He's not, and not what He is. We talk about the belief in God. I believe in something that is a supreme power. I believe in something that is of greater than I. I believe in something that is all-knowing, etc. What it means is that there are things that I believe there is something there that is not like anything else.
We don't know what he is or is he there, but we hope and we feel that there's something that's giving us this feeling.
So you're talking about hope, and that's where we get into the aspect of belief. Okay? So before we get into that, let's look at this concept of belief in God. Okay? Because they're going to discuss the difference between belief and knowledge. There's a hope, right? There's not a knowledge. We're going to discuss that in just a second. Let's begin. Is there a commandment to believe in God?
No.
No. Anyone? No. The answer, of course, like every good Jewish question, is maybe. Right? Maybe. Right? No, in fact, we are supposed to think about it, as we'll discuss it. If we can look at it, have you ever heard of the Decalogue?
Yes.
What is the Decalogue?
The Ten Commandments.
Right? The Ten Commandments. Decalogue is actually Greek. Deco meaning...
Ten
and log meaning
commandment.
It's not really commandments. It's more of sayings. We're going to see that's actually a more appropriate definition than what we know it is in the English definition of commandment. Let's look where that find that source. That can be found in the Parshat Yitro, which we just read a number of weeks ago. If you're in our local Stone Chumash, you will find it in page 406. And if you're in the Hertz, I don't know what to tell you. You're on chapter 20, verse 1 of the book of Exodus, Shemot. Okay, so chapter 20, verse 1 in the book of Shemot, page 406, we are introduced to the Decalogue, right? Now, as I said, this is a concept called the Ten Commandments. Now, the Ten Commandments are a really poor translation, because in fact, you will find there are most likely many more commandments than just ten in the Ten Commandments. Right? In Hebrew, what do we call them? Haseret HaDibrot. What is a Dibra? What is it?
Sayings.
They're really ten sayings. Because within the commandments, or these sayings, there are many commandments. And some of them might not be a commandment at all. Which brings us to that, whether to answer our question. Let's look at the opening line. Verse 1, God spoke to all these things, saying. And verse 2 is where we begin. Everybody with me? Okay, chapter 20, verse 2, page 406 in the stone, and in the Hertz you're on your own. Okay? What's that there?
Okay.
It says as follows. I am the Lord your God, Anochi Hashem Lokecha, Asher Hotzeiticha Me'eretz Mitzrayim, Me'beit Avadim, that took you out of the land of Egypt, from the house of slavery. Okay? This is the first of the Ten Commandments. What is it telling us?
That he was afraid. They don't know who he is.
Ah. So the first explanation, very good. There are opinions that say that all this is an introduction. In fact, if you go to the Christian Ten Commandments, they don't list this as a commandment. If you go to us, we have the first one is right over there. You have like visual aids there. Right? The first one that says, Anochi Hashem, I am the Lord your God. Right? According to us, it's a commandment. According to the Christians, it's not a commandment. In fact, it's just an introduction. It's basically saying, hi, I'm God, how are you? I'll be delivering this speech, right? And you need to know who you're talking to, right? So who, what, big deal to give you all these commandments, I might as well give you the introduction. So before I give you the introduction, let me tell you who I am. Before I gave you this class, I told you who I was. Or you needed to know who I was. Otherwise, why would I have believability? Yes?
But he's saying, in effect, he's saying, there's only one of me. He's also saying, there's only one.
Well,
I am God.
Right. But, what is the purpose of the statement? What is the purpose of the statement?
To say that he is a higher being.
To say he's a higher being. What's the purpose of him saying he's a higher being? Is it a commandment? Or is it a statement? Or is an introduction.
He had to introduce himself because they were believing many gods.
Right.
So he says, I'm the God of your forefather. So they have a connection, an historical.
Many of the biblical commentaries have said that this is just an introduction, and therefore it is not a commandment. It's not a mitzvah. Right? And in fact, the Catholics believe that, Christians believe that, and they say, and so what do they do with the Ten Commandments? Anybody know?
No.
I mean, they still have Ten Commandments, so if you got rid of the first one,
number 2 into 2.
What? You combine number 2 into 2, you combine number 10 into 2, right? I had a friend who I had converted and he taught me a lot. So he was explaining to me the difference of Christian theology and Jewish theology is very interesting. And he basically the last of the 10 commandments tell us that he said that there are different schools of thought within the Christian world, and one of the schools of thought is the last of the Ten Commandments is actually thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, covet nor is their property. So that's two separate commandments. Okay, but in Judaism we do have this. It tells us that the first one is I'm the Lord your God who took us out of the land of Egypt. Some say it is not a commandment. Others say it actually is a mitzvah. It is a mitzvah to believe in God. And that is one of the ten, they're not ten commandments, there's ten sayings, this is nonetheless a commandment, and we have a mandate to believe in God. The first question is, can God give us a mandate to feel something?
Belief is not something that you control.
Okay.
So you could ask yourself questions, you could not believe. I don't know what I think that even if you don't believe, if you do the good things you're supposed to do, just in case. You know, like if you're not sure, you should still do what you're supposed to do.
The just in case. To cover all bases.
Yeah.
Well, then the question becomes is what am I supposed to do?
Well, you're supposed to be good.
It's supposed to be good?
Yeah.
Okay. That's a very dangerous statement. You're a very nice person, but I'm going to attack you now. What does it mean to be good? Who says what? Right?
That could be different.
Right? Just because if you ask the famous questions they taught us in rabbinical school, I remember one class. It was one interesting class. There were a lot of classes. One of them was interesting. One of the classes they said is that if you brought people into the room, right, if you had four people in the room, let's say Mother Teresa, at the time it was let's say Saddam Hussein of may his memory continue to be erased, and may he rest in pieces, as they used to say, right? Saddam Hussein, what's his name? Osama bin Laden, Mother Teresa, Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, and we're not even going to bring him into the equation, thank God. But and let's say Rabbi the Chavetz Chaim, Rabbi Strahlmeier Kagan HaKohen, one of the great pious individuals of our history, who was wrote many works, including one of the focuses of not speaking about slander. Right? If you've never heard of the Chavetz Chaim, you should. Great man, lived in the early 20th century, passed away in 1930. Right? So they have those four people in the room, and you say to them, "Do you think you're a good person?" What would the answers be?
Yes.
All of them will answer that?
No, sir. The Chavetz Chaim probably wouldn't.
The Chavetz Chaim wouldn't. Mother Teresa?
Wouldn't.
Well, we found out that she had a lot of doubts to begin with, right? But she would say, she probably went, what about our good friends Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden?
Absolutely.
Right? Of course, they're very good people. They believe they're doing what they're doing is 100% right. So the question, when you start saying, just do the right thing, forget about belief, forget about just to cover your bases, it's a very dangerous thing.
I didn't say forget about your belief.
But, so what did you say?
I said you cannot control what you believe or not. So if you're not sure
you're correct that you not necessarily can't control, right? Mm-hmm. Because then we're going to get to that in the practical level in just a second. Well, here we see that there is some sort of mandate, whatever it is, according to many opinions, that one is supposed to believe. You're supposed to believe. We're going to get into that about as we study the verse in a second, but now I'm going to talk about the practical again, right? If you were interested, let's say it is a combination of the two. It is an introduction, right? God introducing himself. And it is also a mandate to say, I am the Lord your God. I took you out of the land of Egypt. Now you know this is my business card, right? This is my business card. And I want you to believe in me, right? Why am I telling you this? Because I'm about to give you 613 commandments, some of them are not as easy as they look, right? And I want you to follow them. So therefore, why would you be following them if you didn't believe in me? So we have, let's say there's those combinations of the two. So here we are, and God says, I want you to believe in me, right? Why wouldn't...
Not believe, accept.
Accept.
Not accept, no. After all, he says, no. I'm the guy which took you out of Egypt. Believe, he just came out of this experience.
Accept. Knowledge.
Because when things happen, you're not supposed to question, you're supposed to accept them.
Well, let's slow down. Is that you took the course, right? Belief, accept, knowledge. Wait, if we talk about, it doesn't talk about belief, right? It doesn't talk, when you talk about I'm the Lord your God, he should say, after I took you out of the land of Egypt. In other words, if you read the previous chapters, you saw the movie, you saw the incredible miracles that we just did, right? Watched it on CNN or whatever it is. So therefore, hands on, you know who I am. Therefore, you should follow my laws. But that's not what we say. In Judaism, we don't say that you have to know God. What do we say? What's the name of the course?
Belief
in God. Right? Now, what is the difference between belief and knowledge?
Knowledge laughter. Means the facts have been proven.
Knowledge means the facts have been proven. Okay? When God introduces himself, it's not speaking to us per se. This is actually happening. Right? This is his resume. They saw this happen. But there is no mandate to know God. The mandate is to believe in God. As we've talked about in Jewish history, there has been a major concept of believing in God, of having faith, of hoping, right? Hoping that this is real. It's a very big difference between knowledge and belief. If I say I believe someone is in the other room, right, what does that mean?
Someone's in the other room.
Not necessarily. No. It could have been that the wind blew it over, right, or the fish jumped out of the fish tank or whatever it was, right? When I was a kid, we always had a cat. So the cat was always making trouble. If there was a burglar, nobody noticed because the cat was always jumping on things, right? So I believe someone is in the house. I can believe it. Why? Because there is evidence to show me that there's possibly someone in the house. How many times have we had that and we're actually about to check and we were wrong? Right? Depends how paranoid you are. Right? So, I wouldn't be so paranoid if people stopped talking about me. Right? So, if there's a very big difference between I believe someone's in the other room versus I know someone's in the other room. I know you're in the room in front of me. I mean, the truth is that, you know, there's today, we could say that, how do I really know this? But with all scientific evidence, I could say that you are standing in this room in front of me, right? I believe there's a meeting going on there in the next room. I don't know what they're talking about, but but they're having a meeting in the next room. Why? Because last time I was there, I saw them. They could have left by now, right? I have belief that they're there. I know that you're here.
It's against what I study, because what I study was the difference between Judaism and everybody else is that we do not tell to the Jews, believe, we know. They knew, we know, we are part of history.
Is that true? I believe with a perfect faith. Anybody hear that before?
Yes.
Where does that come from?
13
principles of faith. It's a good thing to look up if you have a chance. You find it in any Siddur. The Maimonides has its 13 principles of faith, right? It's actually a good thing to know. There will be a course, God willing, next year on the 13 principles of faith, because it says, Maimonides says, if you don't believe in them, then you're not part of the fold. So, and we can stone you for fun, but that's another discussion, right?
It depends how you were raised, because in some homes you're raised, this is the way it is, this is what God said. No, don't question it.
That doesn't mean that it was right.
No, I'm not saying that. By the Hasidim, if they say that it's green outside,
doesn't mean it's right.
I can say it's right.
Right.
So maybe he's saying he learned it this way because that's the way he was taught.
But what does Judaism say?
Well,
right? There's an old line that says, I always tell people when they say, well, if someone's a religious Jew, how could they be doing this, that, and the other thing? And I always say, I quote, don't judge Judaism by the Jews. Right? What does Judaism say? That's the question. Judaism, if you're looking at this Chumash, I follow stone Chumash, art scroll came from Sinai, we all know that, right? If I follow the stone Chumash, it tells me that doesn't it tell me about knowing there is a prevalent theme of believing? It's a prevalent theme of believing. Maimonides' 13 principles of faith does not say, I know with a perfect knowledge. He says, I believe with a perfect faith.
But that's what this is what he said, which is wonderful. But God says, Anohi Adonai. It's a statement. I am God. And by the way, you know who I am? I'm the guy who took you out, just
but
so you
know.
But
he doesn't say, know who I am.
He says, Anohi Adonai.
Doesn't matter.
I am God.
There is no man. Then why doesn't he say, I want you to know this, and therefore I want you to have knowledge of God? Now, it does say that God wants us to know him. He wants us. What does God ask from you? Only to know him, and to cling to him. Right? But that's a process. That's not knowledge. It's to get to know.
And you go to know him through belief.
Well, that's correct. I think they're two separate things. Now I'll explain. There's a beautiful... anybody ever hear of our friend Hillel?
Yeah.
From Talmud, right? Hillel is an amazing individual. Hillel is really a brilliant individual who became one of the leaders of our faith leaders of our people for a period of time, and he of course had a counterpart named Shammai, right? Hillel and Shammai had very different schools of thought. They had different schools, right? Now there are numerous stories of Hillel and Shammai. There's a famous story in the Talmud tractate Shabbat, page 31, there are a number of stories that took place. And Hillel, for example, a convert comes over to Shammai, or someone comes over, a potential convert comes over to Shammai and says, "Teach me Torah on one foot." And what does Shammai say? What does Shammai say?
Out.
Get out. Says that he chased him away with a building stick, a beam of a building stick. Right? Some of the commentators explained is that he was trying to say, listen, this is a beam. You can't just say, oh, I want to get everything from one single beam. There's a process in building the beams, right? So that's one explanation. And what did Hillel say? That's not what he said. That was what the Torah said. What did Hillel say? He said, don't do unto others what you wouldn't want to be done to yourself. It's different than love thy neighbor as thyself, right? Don't do unto others what you wouldn't have done. It's very important because when we get into our class of love thy neighbor as thyself, you have to, you'll follow that and you'll see that soon. So this is one of the examples of Hillel's patience. According to the Talmud, told the story of Hillel. They said that somebody bet $400, which was a lot of money in those days, that they could get Hillel angry. You know the story? It's one of my favorite stories, right? Guy calls up Hillel and says, "I bet you $400 you can't get Hillel angry." So he goes, waits till Hillel is about to get into the shower, right before the Sabbath, right before Shabbat, and he knocks on his door and he says, Hillel, I have an important question." Hillel runs down in his bathrobe, says big H on the back, and he says, "I have a question." He says, "Why do Ethiopians have big feet?" And Hillel says, "Very good question. It's good question. I don't know. Maybe it's because they have to walk on the sand." A minute later, Hillel goes back, dumps in the suds, right? And a guy knocks on the door and says, Hillel, a very important question. Hillel runs out again and says, "Why do Asians have small eyes?" Right? And Hillel says, "Very good." Meanwhile, this guy was trying to tick him off, and ultimately he couldn't get Hillel upset. Hillel was a great tzaddik, right? So Hillel, there's a story, one of the stories in the series of stories of Hillel's, is that Hillel, they went over to Shammai first and said, "I want you to teach me the entire Torah, but not the oral Torah." For those of you who are not familiar, we believe that this came from Sinai, right? But so was the oral explanation. And that there are many cases where you cannot understand this at all without having the oral explanation. For example, how do we know we don't eat meat and milk?
Well, there's the sentence.
What does the sentence say?
You will not boil the kid as in the
kid. Do not lo tavashel gadiba chelev imo. Don't cook a goat, a kid, in its mother's milk. How do I know I can't have a cheeseburger? Mm. Right? That's part of the oral Torah. And there are numerous examples of that. And so, here we have, Shammai says, "You want me to teach you only the written Torah, but you don't want to believe in the oral Torah?" He chases him out. Hillel says, "Okay, come, let's go to class." And the first day he teaches him Aleph, second day he teaches him Bet, third day he teaches him Gimel and Dalet, etc. Comes the fourth day, and he shows them that it's not Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, but actually he starts writing on the board, Dalet, Gimel, Bet, Aleph. The guy stands up and says, "What are you talking about? How can that possibly be? Right? You just told me everything you told me." He says, "What do you know? I'm your teacher, right? How can you know anything? I'm the one who taught you Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, so I could teach you Dalet, Bet, Gimel, and Aleph. Dalet, Gimel, Bet, Aleph, right?" In other words, he says, "If you really want to understand this, we got to learn the whole package, and then you could decide." He says, "What many of the commentaries take this very nice story is the power of whether or not one can doubt or not." So Shammai, he goes over and says, "I can't believe in the oral Torah, give me the written Torah," and he throws him out. Hillel says, "Sure, come on in, right? I'll teach you different things, and you could decide afterwards what you want, right? Whether or not you believe in the oral or the written, you have to learn the whole thing before you be able to decide, right? You have to have a certain knowledge base before you can decide whether or not you believe or not." But what, according to many, they're saying, is whether or not one can have doubt. To Shammai, as you were saying, there was no doubt. It's all or nothing, right? And you cannot have questions. To Hillel, and this is how we conclude, is that there is the possibility of doubt. In order to have doubt, you have to have a knowledge base. In order to be what we call an apikoros, which is someone who is a non-believer, you have to know a lot.
You have to know
a lot.
What you're not believing.
Exactly. You have to know, and then you can ask questions. But throughout that process, you can always ask questions throughout. You can always have doubt. Because God never tells us to know. In fact, one thing you mentioned before, the Talmud says the same thing. God can never tell us to believe. Or can't force us to believe. Now, God could do everything. God is all-knowledgeable, right? God is all-powerful. God can't force you to believe. Because at the end of the day, belief has to come through a process. I have to gain knowledge and ask more questions. And then ask and go back and forth and get them answered. And it's a constant process. And so this belief in God, this constant belief in God, when Mother Teresa came out and said, or they came after her death and said that she had doubts, a lot of those in her world were so upset. How can this possibly she have doubts? Right? For Judaism, it's not a problem. It's okay to have doubts. Because we're not told to know, we're told to believe.
We're not perfect.
It's not just we're not perfect. Part of the process of knowing is to start asking the questions. Is to ask the questions and learn and ask and doubt and question. And continue to learn.
So those that they ask the question and then, and the end of everything, do they believe or they know?
When I find someone who got to the end,
you let me
then
know.
I'll let you know.
You leave me.
Right. It's a long process. No one I know has ever finished the end of it. Right. Now, if you ask anybody whether or not they know of God's existence, if they say yes, I'm a little skeptical.
Even those that experience during Yetziat Mitzrayim, even those that experience during Matan Torah.
If you experience something, well, okay, what happened to them? What was the end of their story?
I'm not sure where you're leaning.
Continue, read the rest of this book. Where do they end up, these people?
Okay. Here?
They built the Egel Hazav, the golden calf. They died. They rebelled 10 times, and they died. They're condemned to die in the desert. Why? Because they didn't have true belief. And it says, because they did not believe in me. Right? In other words, individual experiences are very short-lived. At the end of the day, it's about knowledge. Now, granted, if something starts floating in the air, right, or if I had a premonition and God started speaking to me, and then I would have reason to believe, but it's only short-lived. There's an old saying that says that when God speaks, when you speak to God, it's called prayer. When God speaks to you, it's called psychosis, right? You should be very nervous if someone says that God spoke to them, right? But we don't have prophecy these days. No one is being told what to do. No one's being told there is no such thing as knowledge. And even those who had that experience, the experience is very short-lived. Psychologically, if you thought about it, you'd understand that everything, it's too much of a high. It can't last. Okay, everybody with me? Yeah? Mm-hmm. Okay. So, as we understand, practically, right, we start realizing that belief in God doesn't just mean to know God, it means to have questions. And I want to come into the issue you brought up before, is that when you talk about belief in God, right, so you say, well, you believe in what to do, right? You say, well, at the end of the day, be a good person. Let's look at this text for a second. Okay? It says, I am the Lord your God that took you out of the land of Egypt from the house of slavery. Okay, now what does he mean by this? What do you mean by this? I am the Lord your God that took you out of the land of Egypt from the house of slavery. You could spend months and months on this verse. Okay, what do we extrapolate? Think, right? I always thought I when I was a student, so I used to drive my teachers crazy because I would every time they would say, oh, the Talmud says this, and I would say, well, what do you mean by that? Right? So this is how you learn. This is the only way you learn. Is I want you to be the teachers and you're going to say, what do we come up with? What does this verse tell us? What questions do we have on this verse?
Well, does God mean you owe me? I took you out.
So okay. Does it mean you owe me? Right? According to the explanation we had before, God is giving this introduction to say, hey, right, this is my resume. So I took you out of Egypt, you owe me. Anybody else? Yes?
Because I was able to take you out. I am powerful. Who else could have done it?
Uh-huh. I am powerful. Why? What's the big deal about Egypt?
Well, they were slaves, so they want to take them out.
Well, if they were slaves in Beth Zion prison, it wouldn't be a big deal, right? If they were, sometimes I feel that way. If they were slaves in Egypt, Egypt was the supreme power of the world. It was impenetrable. It was the Iron Curtain, right? When we talk about it, so it wasn't that I just took you out of slavery, right? But I took you out of the land of Mitzrayim, mi beit avadim. It says two things. Didn't have to say that, right? I'm doing a little too much teaching when I would have liked to, right? It could have said, I took you out of Egypt, right? We all know what that meant. But he took you out from the land of Egypt, which was significant, which was a bigger deal than taking you out of slavery. Mi beit avadim, from the house of slavery, which means that you owe me, right? But also that I have the power to take you out of anywhere. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say the power he had was to create the 10 plagues in order to get them out. I had the power over, like you said, it was a supreme being in Egypt, or supreme power in Egypt. Notwithstanding that, he created 10 plagues and got them out anyway.
Got them out anyway, right? So, there's really a dichotomy here, right? You have two things. Number one, you have I stood up to the supreme power. I am all powerful. I am the god of the big powers, right? And also, I took you out from the house of slavery, which means from your house. I am the god of the individuals. From that one verse.
I don't think he's saying you owe me. He just stated a fact.
Could be.
What I did for you.
Could be. I mean, it could be that he says he doesn't owe me. Well, yeah, I mean, it's open to interpretation, right?
Winter, it's a fact. Today.
You were there, you saw it, right? And it's also, but again, this is clearly some form of introduction. Whether or not there's a commandment in there or not, it doesn't matter. But some form of introduction, he's saying, let me describe who I am. Let me show you my resume, right? My resume is, when we're talking about who I am, I can take care of the big boys, right? And I'm also part of the house of slavery. I took you out of this house of slavery.
Do you have any Mishnah which tried to explain why he said that? In other words, maybe the people are thinking that Moshe did that and not him, or the Oran
according to the Torah. According to the Torah, and I'm not according to the Midrash, it says that God said the first two commandments and the last eight, Moshe said it. It's actually said in the Torah.
Yeah, but why he had to say that? That's the whole thing. They just why did he have to introduce himself? They saw what happened. So they weren't so believing.
Well,
that
one of the reasons is because it's Morashah Kehilat Yaakov. It is an inheritance, an heirloom. It's not just for that generation. It was known.
So this book was, will know that.
This book was being written for generations to come, 3,300 years later. Right?
Yeah.
So that's one clear
explanation. It wasn't for them necessarily.
Right. Let's take a step back for a second. If we're talking about God's resume, right? What would you, if you were God, which some of us have this complex, right? what would you put on your resume? What's the number one thing you put on your resume?
Your historical activities, whatever you did, and that's what he said.
Historical activities.
Your activities.
Okay, this was
your credits.
Oh, right, you put on your credits, just like right. I would put on my credits when I put on my resume. At top of it says, right, Rabbi of the adult education course on Tuesday evenings at Beth Zion, right? That's my number one thing for you, right? All right, that's, I'm going to put on my resume. I'm putting my relevant work experience, right? If you're God, what is your relevant work experience? What are you putting on?
I created the world.
That was a big one.
That was a big one.
That was a pretty big one. That was the biggest of the big. Right? If you were for God, and you were writing your resume in large print, block letters, right, with bold and the whole thing, right, a big font, you put on, I am the Lord your God who created the world. And everybody would see, you see the world, you know it's real. Right? Why didn't God do that?
Because nobody saw him do it.
Because nobody saw him do that. Okay. So what?
They saw they got out of slavery, but they didn't see him create the world.
So what?
They would have to believe that he did it. They can't.
So for here, this was knowledge. I wasn't there 3,300 years ago either.
That's right.
Right? So you're right. For this introduction, it's relevant. Why wouldn't he mention it? Why wouldn't he mention now for the future generations about the God who created the world? What? Modesty. We don't believe in that with God. I could be modest. I pride myself on my humility, right? So, why doesn't God mention that he created the world?
That's an excellent question.
Thank you. That's why I'm the teacher.
This is his latest achievement. The people have been there for 400 years. Maybe they don't believe anymore.
Maybe they don't believe he created the world?
No, maybe they don't believe he's there after 400
years. So Alan has a very good point. The question is now, to believe that God created the world, if you ask people on the street whether or not God created the world, right, whether or not there was a first creator, what would they tell you?
How should I know?
I wasn't there, right? Most people would say, yeah, they believe there was some form of original creator. That the world can't have just simply existed. Most people would probably say, oh, I never really thought about that, right? but if you actually put them to the test and said, what do you believe? Do you believe there was an original creator? Most people will say yes. Whether or not it came from a big bang, right, or it came from anything, an original creator that created mass, etc., most people believe there was something. The question is what about in 2008 or in 2448 in the Jewish calendar? As Alan was pointing out, we believe that, but there's a concept called deism. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who is a great poet and philosopher of the Jewish history in the 11th century, he writes this idea, and he says that God needed to put this in because belief in God, he needed to counteract what was the popular belief at that time, was that God created the world and then sort of took a step back. Or that God created the world is involved in very important things, mathematical equations, you know, figuring out who's going to win the Super Bowl this year or whatever, right? And then the small things, he's too busy, right? And so what they have to do is counteract that. And so he said, let me tell you, I created the world, which was very impressive, by the way, right? I have great pictures. But I took you out of the land of Egypt, and I took you out of the house of slavery, which means that, A, I'm still here, I'm still pushing the buttons, I'm still around. It is a concept in Judaism called Hashkacha Pratit. Hashkacha, which means watch, right? Like a mashgiach, which means to watch. Pratit, specifics. God watches specifics. And so here, this belief in God, people believe there was a God. They believe in some form of God, not necessarily monotheism, believe in some form of God. He says, I'm the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt, right? And from the house of slavery, I'm still here, I still push up the buttons, and I took you out of your house of slavery on the street that you lived in, from your home and your block, etc. And this was extremely powerful. This changed the world. Now what? So now that I believe that God is here and he created the world and then he's also involved in my practical daily life, so then what? So what's the big deal? Well, if you keep reading, you'll see, as I said, you can spend hours and hours, I took you out of the land of Egypt. What do we know about Egypt besides being the supreme power of the world? It was one of the supreme cultured of the world, right? Everybody hear of hieroglyphics? Mm-hmm. Right? Have you heard of hieroglyphics? The Egyptians were the ones. They were the builders. They had help from Jews. Jews were good architects, right? They built the pyramids. They were in hieroglyphics. They were one of the more cultured people of that period of time. Much more so than, you have to remember, there were tribes. There were these tribes everywhere that were really very unsophisticated and uncultured. The Egyptians had culture. They had theater. They had circuses. They had all these things, right? So God says, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt. Not just physically, but I want you to understand the difference of taking you out of Egypt. I want to show you another reference, because you talked about this before, of the what does it mean practically to believe in God. And if you look at, and hold this page, because we're going to come back, but if you look at on the book of Parshat Vayera, we're going to jump back to our old friend Abraham. And
you know him too?
I don't know him personally.
My old friend? But
I spent a lot of quality time with him. Okay? On page 92. Chapter 20. verse 10 or verse 9. Okay, again in the Stone Chumash, page 92. What we're going to do is we're going to ask, what is the practical ramifications of believing in God? And the answer, okay, again, we're on page 92. And if you look at verse 9, well, just a little background, is that Abraham, there was a hunger in the land, so he went to the land of the Philistines, which was in Israel as well, right? Remember that the Jewish people don't exist yet, it's just Abraham, right, and his wife. And so they go to the land of the Philistim, this area, and he is greeted very welcomed, right? And then what happens is he comes into the place and they say, he realizes that his wife Sarah is very beautiful and says, can you do me a favor? Can you mention that? If they ask you, tell them you're my sister. So they tell him, sure enough, at the time they said, who is this? And he goes, this is my sister. We travel together. And sure enough, she was kidnapped by the king, Abimelech. And Abimelech gets an angel comes to Abimelech and says, I'm going to kill you because you stole the wife of a prophet and she's a prophetess as well. And therefore, you're going to be punished. Abimelech wakes up the next day and says as follows. Verse 8, if you want to learn. Abimelech woke up, we'll read in English. Abimelech arose early next morning. He summoned to all his servants and told them all these things in their ears. And the people were very frightened. Then Abimelech summoned Abraham and said to him, what have you done to us? How have I sinned against you that you brought upon me my kingdom such great sins? Deeds that ought to be done, ought not to be have done, have you done to me? Right? Who's the victim here?
Abraham.
Right? Who?
Abraham
is the victim. But who's claiming to be the victim?
The king.
Abimelech is claiming to be. How could you have done this to me? Right? Why? Because, and said Abimelech, said Abraham, what did you see that you did such a thing? Why did you tell me she was your sister? I almost committed a horrible, heinous crime. We don't do that here. And what does Abraham say? And Abraham said, because I said, there is but no fear of God in this place, and they will slay me because of my wife. The Philistines were also an incredibly cultured people. They lived by the coast, right? Ashkelon, Ashdod, all around Tel Aviv, right? If you're part of the coast, right? So what does that mean? It means you control the waters, which means you're into trade and you're doing very well financially. So they were a very sophisticated group. And then Abimelech says, I would never, if you told me she was your wife, I would never have kidnapped her. I almost committed a horrible crime. I almost had an affair with a married woman. We would never do such a thing. And what does God say? What does Abraham say? I saw there was no fear of God here. Therefore, I was worried that you would kill me. Why?
How could he see that?
How can he see that? So the Gemara asks this question. The Gemara in Makot asks the question and says, well, how did he know? They said, because he showed up into this town, and when he entered the town's gates, normally when you show up to Montreal, right? So what do people say when you first show up?
Hello.
Where are you? Hi, where are you staying? Right? Do you have any food? Can I offer you, you know, you need something to eat? Where are you davening? Can I get membership from you? Etc. Right? So they
Donation.
That was the questions they typically ask. What do they ask him when he shows up? They say, is this your wife or is this your sister? He says, ah.
There's a problem.
There's a problem here, right? That you might seem to be a very moral and ethical society, but if you have no fear of God, what's going to happen?
Wait a second. Why he says she's my sister? What he was thinking? What's the difference between
they're going to kill him otherwise.
If that was his wife, will kill him to take the wife.
They'll kill him to take his wife.
And this way, they wouldn't kill him, will take the wife anyway, as a sister.
Yeah, he's just a sister.
So he was afraid of his life.
He was afraid of his life. That's what he
says. Not the wife.
No, he didn't care about her. No.
But that's what he's coming out of.
Well, he's afraid that she'll kill him, that he'll be killed.
We want to know. Right? Abraham Avinu.
So this was some form of protection. Why does he say this? Because if there's no fear of God, it doesn't matter if you're the most moral and ethical society. It doesn't matter if you say, I just want to do the right thing. If you don't have a belief in something of a higher being, of right and wrong, then you can come up with a million excuses. You could frame them. You could say, well, he wasn't a good guy to begin with. You can come up with a million ways to be able to get to his wife one way or another and kill him. And make her vow. I would never, ever, ever have an affair with a married woman. So I'll just kill you. And that's exactly what he was worried about. So on a practical level, we say, if you don't believe in God, right, you can't just say, I want to be a good person, right? There has to be some form of belief. Now, again, there's belief. Is there still doubt? But there's belief that I know that there is something there. He calls it fear of the Lord. Fear of the Lord. You know, that there's a higher, you answer to a higher authority.
Sorry, but we are mixing up notions. To fear the Lord could come if you know the Lord. It's not a question of believing in the Lord. You can know that there is a God, and you fear Him. Or you can know that there is a God, and you do not fear Him.
You're using this term knowledge is very, very loosely. Right? I'll tell you, when I was a kid, right, when I was 18 years old, I knew everything. Right? I knew everything. You could ask me. I'll tell you. I knew everything. Right? And then I got a little older, and I realized I didn't know anything then. Right? But now I know everything. And I became 22, 23, whatever. I said, wow, what was I thinking back then? Right? I was wrong. I thought I knew everything. How could I have known? I'm experiencing more. So I didn't know anything back then. But now I know everything. Then I got married, and I realized I don't know anything. Right? And it's right. No one knows anything. Knowledge is the word to know is a very dangerous term. And God says, I'm not asking you to know anything. I want you to believe. I want you to have the process of knowledge. Leida is to get to the process of knowledge.
Dati is somebody that knows. Miladat is the religious people. It's a wrong translation.
It's a wrong translation.
You are religious.
The term dati means ladat. Right. Right. There is a word ladat to know, right? But if someone asks me, what is the best way to describe myself? I would have to say, and I ripped this off somebody, right? I would have to say an unfinished product, right? I can't know it. To know means I'm finished. I can't know. I don't know yet.
Or you understand what you're supposed to know.
I don't know. I understand what I'm supposed to know. I'm hoping I'm in the right direction. But every day I have another question.
If you've been provided rules and you could say, I know, I understand what I have been provided. I believe I understand.
Again, we're arguing semantics. I can't say for sure. At the end of the day, we're arguing semantics, right? Even you want to say the dati, the word dati. Who's to say the dot? You want to translate it means knowledge. That's an English term that we're familiar with. Deya, right? Chachma, bina, v'dat, right? Is there a form of information? Doesn't necessarily mean it's knowledge as it's being defined by you. Okay, I want you to think about it. That's what we're here for. I'm hoping you won't be able to sleep tonight because. Okay, everybody with me so far? So what we've learned so far is that there is a concept of believing in God, right? That belief doesn't have to mean an all or nothing concept. There's a concept of that God is. I believe in God. That God is not just there. Didn't just create the world and wind it like a clock, but he is involved in the everyday acts of this world, and he's involved in my world as well. Hashkacha pratit, a very powerful word. Hashkacha, watching of the specifics. And then practically what that means is that if I believe in a higher authority, that means I have to answer, not just by Hebrew National. And I have to answer to the higher authority is that if there is something greater than what we call universal morality. Which is what you were describing. Universal morality is whatever I think is right is right. Right? That's what universal morality is.
Yeah, but that's not what I was saying.
But that's universal morality. But you understand that there's a higher being, right? You understand there's a higher being, then you understand that there can't just be universal morality. There has to be something, some other way to answer. And universal morality is an extremely dangerous concept. Now with that comes the question is that now, if I believe that God created the world, and I believe that he's actively involved in this world, then the question is what am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? What does it mean to me that God created the world? How am I supposed to behave? We talked about universal morality. What is the morality that is supposed to be? Right? And the answer is that there comes the rest of the book. The rest of the book is there to tell us, oh, okay, now do you understand this? Well, now this is what I'm asking you to follow. This is what I'm asking you to do. You do this, this is, and we'll get into more details when we discuss in the fourth class of Jewish observance, right? What does it mean, observance, observing things, right? It means, but here, at least in superficially, it means to believe in God. Then there is, if you believe that God created the world and there is instructions, he put in certain instructions on what to do in this world, so now I have to read the book and find out what they are. As when the convert came over to Shammai and said, teach me Torah on one foot, he said, he threw him out. When he came over to Hillel, Hillel said, don't do to others what you wanted to do, what you wouldn't want to be done yourself. The rest is just drash. Go, zil v'lamad, go and learn. And that is the challenge. The challenge we have now is to say, okay, now that I believe, now I have to go and learn and say, well, what does that mean practically? Okay? Everybody with me on this, because then we're going to jump into something much more sophisticated, which at the end of class, I'm going to probably lose 80% of you. So, okay? This is the end of class, part one. I'm going to explain to you a concept, Kabbalistically, of how we understand the belief of God. Does Judaism believe in monotheism?
Yes.
What does monotheism mean?
One God.
One God. Okay. If you pictured one God, right? How do we picture God in our head? By the way, you're not allowed to do that. So if you get struck by lightning, I apologize. Right? What do you, when you picture God, when you were a kid, right? Or whatever. When you pictured God in your head, what did you think of?
An old man.
Always, it looked like Santa Claus, right? And the old man with long white beard and a big throne up in the sky.
A beautiful smile.
Very nice. Anybody else?
A warm sun.
Anybody else? I once asked somebody this question, and they said lightning bolts. Right? Lightning and that kind of has this zoom. It's very nice when you have these feelings. You talk to a lot of people, right? And they say, don't judge a person until you've been in their shoes. People who have gone through, who suffered a lot, will say that God is mean. Right? I mean, thankfully, if you're able to say that I feel God's warmth and I feel God's smile, thank God. Right? Those who've been through horrible tragedies will have much more difficulty doing that, and understandably so. The problem with this is that doesn't necessarily mean, where do we find this definition of monotheism? The definition of monotheism, right, that there's one God in this world, you're never going to find this anywhere, right? What does it mean that there's one God? And what does that mean, just that there's one God? Of course, there has to be one God. It can't be that there are many gods. And that's where I am the Lord your God. That's where I comes in. If I wanted to, Kabbalistically, if you look in the writings of Rav Kook, as well as many others who preceded him, you'll see that Judaism doesn't necessarily fully believe in monotheism, but they believe in a concept called panentheism. Now, there's something called pantheism. Anyone know what that is?
No.
Okay. All over. God is in everything. God is in this chair. God is in this table. Right? In the Middle Eastern, in the Far East, you'll find that a lot of people believe in pantheism, therefore they say, I can't use anything in this world because God is in everything. Everything is holy. Judaism doesn't believe in that, right? But what the Kabbalists believe is that that Judaism believes in panentheism, which is the great I, that everything is within God. Everything in this world is within God. Not that God is within everything, but everything in this world is within God. The great I am the Lord your God. What does I mean? Is that everything that we know is reality is God.
Because,
right?
God created the world.
Not that God created the world. God is the world. In other words, the world is within God. Everything in this world is within God.
God was here before he created the world.
Whatever that means, right? We're going to describe this. Of course, much of this we can't really describe because God can't be defined by terms, as we started off, right? We can only say what God isn't. God can't be defined by terms. It becomes very limiting. But ultimately, what we say is that everything, the belief in God is beyond monotheism. It is the belief that everything in this world is within God, including me. And that, this becomes much heavier, and that ultimately, everything exists in this world because God wills it to exist. Because as soon as God decides to shut off one of the channels, he could do that, so to speak. and that I exist in this world as part of God. And my job in this world is the imperfection of God. What does that mean? It means that within everything is perfection and imperfection. Right? And my job as part of the crowning jewel of God is to be the process of perfection in God's imperfection. Meaning that part of not just imperfection, and perfection is in this world, but the process of perfection is in this world. And so ultimately my mandate in this world as part of being part of God is the striving for perfection, is the striving to improve. What we call in this world tikkun olam, right? Fixing this world, or fixing the broken vessels, Kabbalistically, that there are broken vessels in this world, and my job is to fix the broken vessels. And that becomes a much greater discussion, but ultimately what I'm describing to you is that there are much deeper levels of believing in God, superficially, right? Then we have a minimum of believing that there's an all-supreme power. But if you went further and deeper, then you'll see that there are actually much greater understandings of believing in God, and therefore, the greater I believe, it's not just theology, but it's practicality. If I believe in something, right, if I have this understanding, that means I have a greater mandate. If I now believe suddenly that I am a piece of this panentheistic God, so to speak, so now I have an even greater mandate. Which is the same mandate I had yesterday before when I didn't understand this. It just is much more clear to me. Now, I threw this out just because I wanted you to think about it. But this is, perhaps we'll touch upon it a little bit more when we discuss the other aspects of our crash course. But this, I wanted at least for you to get an understanding that there is a greater theology out there than just the basic belief in God. Just something to think about. Didn't mean to scare anybody if I did. And if you have trouble sleeping tonight.